Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Melissa Carvel-Zemer. It's my privilege to serve as a minister of this congregation. And I have to say, I'm surprised to see so many people this morning. When I arrived, I planned a backup service in case it was just me and two others. But I think we'll proceed as planned with this lovely crowd of hardy folk who braved the snow this morning. I'm joined in welcoming you by Sophie Smith, who's serving as our worship associate and was able to make it today. Unfortunately, Karen Lapidus, our director of religious education, lives in Youngstown. And as she started out this morning, a car spun out in front of her and she immediately turned around and went back home. So she's not able to be here today. But our music director, Hal Walker, is with us, as are several intrepid souls from our Golden Tones Junior Choir. So we'll have a lovely morning. We light our chalice this morning with gratitude for the gift of life and for all the seasons life brings us.
Consider a succulent. Succulents have plump, pillowy leaves adapted for storing water during dry times. They have wide, shallow root systems adapted for soaking up rain, mist, and dew. Their cell walls are elastic, enabling them to expand and contract as needed. And they have a thick skin, which helps them to protect the water they have stored. Consider a succulent. What might it teach us about resilience? Come, let us worship together.
As we plan to celebrate our expansion plans, it seemed a good morning to remind ourselves of our church's vision statement. If you'll join me in reading it, it's printed in your order of service. Our vitality and passion call us to restore and expand our space to equal the energy of our dreams. As we do, we are better equipped to carry on our historic legacy and embrace our potential for connection, service, programming, and outreach. This is the time in our service where we join together in spiritual practice. We take time for silence and meditation or prayer, and we begin with words to prepare us, to lead us into that silence. And these words are from the poet Jane Hirschfield. She writes about resilience. The poem is called Optimism. More and more I have come to admire resilience. Not the simple resistance of a pillow whose foam returns over and over to the same shape, but the sinuous tenacity of a tree, finding light newly blocked on one side, it turns in another. A blind intelligence, true, but out of such persistence arose turtles, rivers, mitochondria, figs, all this resinous, unretractable earth. Now, surrounded by the sounds of the traffic outside and people in other parts of our building, we in this space will practice together keeping a few moments of silence. And I'd like to invite you to join with me now in a prayer that has some movements. Many of the movements, three of them, come from American Sign Language. So first I need to teach you a couple of signs if you don't know them. This is the sign for please. With a flat palm, you rub a circle on the upper part of your chest. Please. And this is the sign for thank you. You bring your flat hand right in front of your lips and then bring it down facing up. Thank you. Please and thank you. And one more, this is the sign for bless. You bring your thumbs right under your chin, and then you bring your hands down like this. Bless. So we'll do them again. Please, thank you, and bless. So these three signs will be incorporated into the prayer. So I invite you to keep your eyes open so that you can follow me and join me in this body prayer. We'll begin with our hands in a prayer position. Gracious Spirit of life and of love, we gather this morning with those we love on our hearts and minds. People and animals we know who are sick and suffering, who are joyous, excited, struggling, and confused. We gather this morning with these people, these animals, on our thoughts and in our hearts, and we pray for them, the gifts that they need, gifts of strength or courage or healing or connection. And we ask that you please bless these people in our hearts and in our minds. And we come this morning with our own concerns for ourselves, our aspirations, our dreams, our fears, confusions. And so we ask, please, open our hearts. Open our hearts so that we may find the connections we seek. Connections to others, connections to earth, connections to you. And even as we seek, we know we have also been blessed. And so we take this moment to offer our thanks. Deep thanks for all of these gifts we have been given. Amen, and blessed be.
Our story for all ages today is adapted from Amazing Grace, written by Mary Hoffman. Grace was a girl who loved stories. She didn't mind if they were read to her or told to her or made up in her own head. She didn't care if they were in books or movies or out of Nana's long memory. She just loved stories. After she heard them, Grace would act them out, and she always gave herself the most exciting part. Grace went to battle as Joan of Arc and wove a wicked web as Anansi the spider. She hid inside the wooden horses at the great gates of Troy. She went exploring for lost kingdoms. She sailed into the seven seas with a peg leg and a parrot. She was Hiawatha, sitting with the shining Big Sea Water and Maugoli in the backyard jungle. Most of all, Grace loved to act out adventure stories and fairy tales. She set out to seek her fortune with no companion but her trusty cat, and found a city with streets paved in gold. Or she was Aladdin, rubbing his magic lamp to make the genie appear. Sometimes she would get Ma and Nana to join in when they weren't too busy. Then she was Dr. Grace, and their lives were in her hands. One day, Grace's teacher said that they would be doing the play Peter Pan. Grace knew who she wanted to be. When she raised her hand, Raj said, "You can't be Peter. That's a boy's name." But Grace kept her hand up. "You can't be Peter Pan," whispered Natalie. "He is in black." But Grace kept her hand up. "All right," says the teacher. "Lots of you want to be Peter Pan, so I'll have auditions next week to choose the parts." She gave them the words to learn. When Grace got home, she seemed sad. "What's the matter?" asked Ma. "Raj said I can't be Peter Pan because I'm a girl." That just shows what he knows," said Ma. "A girl can be Peter Pan if she wants to." Grace cheered up. Then later she remembered something else. "Natalie said I can't be Peter Pan because I'm black," she said. Ma looked angry, but before she could speak, Nana said, "It seems that Natalie is another one who doesn't know much. You can be whatever you want to be, Grace, if you put your mind to it." On Sunday, Nana told Grace that they were going out. In the afternoon, they caught a bus into town. Nana took Grace to a grand theater. The sign outside read, "Rosalie Wilkins in Romeo and Juliet in sparkling lights." "Are we going to the ballet, Nana?" asked Grace. "We are, honey, but first I want you to look at this picture." Grace looked up and saw a beautiful young ballerina in a tutu. Above the dancer, it said, "Stunning new Juliet." "This one is little Rosalie from back home in Trinidad," said Nana. "Her grandma and me, we grew up together on the island. She's always asking me if I want to receive tickets to see Rosalie dance. So this time, I said yes. After the ballet, Grace played the part of Juliet, dancing around her room in an imaginary tutu. I can be anything I want, she thought. On Monday, the class met for auditions to choose who would be the best for each part. When it was Grace's turn to be Peter, she knew exactly what to do and all the words to say. She had been Peter Pan all weekend. She took a deep breath and imagined herself flying. When it was time to vote, the class chose Roz to be Captain Hook and Natalie to be Wendy. But there was no doubt who would be Peter Pan. Everyone voted for Grace. You were fantastic, said Natalie. The play was a big success, and Grace was an amazing Peter Pan. After it was all over, she said, I feel as if I could fly all the way home. You probably could, said Mom. Yes, said Nana. If Grace puts her mind to it, she can do anything she wants.
So everybody loves a happy ending, right? Despite being told by her friends that she didn't qualify to play the role of Peter Pan because she was a girl and because she was black, Grace persevered, auditioned, and got the part, and she was an amazing Peter Pan. Grace was very brave and motivated, that's for sure, and those qualities certainly helped her along the way to reach her goal. But what did her ma and her nana do to help her be resilient and encourage her to audition for Peter Pan? If you have ideas, I'll bring the microphone to you. What did her mother and her grandmother do to help her be resilient and encourage her to try out for that part?
They gave her positive feedback.
They gave her positive feedback. Good.
They expressed confidence in her.
They took her to a place where she could see someone who looks like her being successful.
They gave her the example of their true life experience and also showed her role models that she could follow.
Excellent. So those are all wonderful things that her grandmother and her mother did, and they paid off because Grace had this phenomenal experience. But let me ask you a harder question. What if on the day that the auditions happened, Grace had tummy trouble and couldn't go to school, so she didn't get to audition, and someone else in the class got the part, and she was heartbroken? What could her parents, her mother, and her grandmother have done then to help her be resilient and get over her disappointment? What could they have done if that happened?
They could have told her a story from their life about when something they really wanted didn't happen, but it turned out all right in a different way.
Thank you.
I hesitate to say this because I'm not a sports fan, but they could have taken her to a Browns game in Cleveland.
Tried distracting to cheer her up.
I think a first instinct is often to tell people they should not feel the way they feel. And so I think first acknowledging and letting the person feel the disappointment is important.
Thank you.
They could have made a movie similar to The Beast of the Southern Wild with their cell phone, in which a young black girl is a role model to everyone.
One more idea about what they could have done.
Give her a big hug and just be there.
Nice, thank you. These are all great ideas, and I appreciate you being willing to share them with us. These are all ideas about how to help encourage resilience. And this is a hard question about how to encourage resilience, and we know that because Karen and I, at first, our first idea about today was to invite some families to tell us stories about the ways in which they have practiced resilience at home in their own families. And we asked five or six families, and the response that we got was that families are not sure that they're really good at that. And then they're not sure that they're as good at that as they want to be, and that they could use more resources in their tool belt to help them with that. So these are all great ideas, and I want to share with you a few more from Awal. She's a social worker and an educator and a co-director of the Chicago Center for Family Health, and I took a class with her when I was in seminary about resilience and families, and she has some really practical suggestions about ways that families can help encourage resilience at home. And she says that one of those ways is by joining together as a family to help stretch and meet challenges. And we certainly saw that in the story, and some of you had those examples too. Another way is to have hope. Even when things seem really challenging, to find a way to have hope. And not necessarily a hope that everything is going to turn out rosy at the end, but a hope that you're going to grow through this challenging experience and come out the other side. She says resilient families have moral and spiritual foundations that they can draw upon. Those can include religious communities like this, or they can include spiritual nourishment through connections with nature or music or art. All of those kinds of connections are really important for families to cultivate in order to tap into sources of hope to help get them through the challenging times. She also says that resilient families are flexible, that they're not tied into doing everything always exactly the same way, that if a new challenge arises that doesn't necessarily fit the models the family has already used many times successfully, the family is willing to try something new. Resilient families know that they can count on each other during times of crisis, that they don't have to do it alone. And resilient families realize that not only do the individuals not have to do it alone, the family doesn't have to do it alone either, because they have networks of people outside the family that they can rely upon. Resilient families trust each other. They trust each other to say what they mean and mean what they say. And resilient families look for opportunities to celebrate, have fun, and enjoy themselves together. And finally, resilient families, she says, identify problems and options, and they work together as a team to meet the challenges that face them. So these are all resources that she says resilient families can practice cultivating in their family life to be more resilient. And I'd like to point out, if it's not obvious, that several of these involve reaching out beyond the family into other communities. And this congregation is a community, like many other congregations, that can help families practice being resilient. So being resilient is a lesson that we have to keep learning over and over again throughout life. It's a lesson we have to keep cultivating and teaching to those that we share our lives with. And the very first teacher in resilience, we hope, are the people that we share our homes with. Resilience, we hope, starts at home. In exploring resilience, so often our culture talks about resilience as just an individual thing. And that hymn speaks about the ways in which we're not on our own. We're not just individuals. And I think when it comes to resilience, it's not something that, you know, people just form all by themselves. We form it in relationship with other people, and not just with our families, though that's hopefully where it starts, but also in relationship with our communities. And I want to tell you some stories this morning about this community, this congregation, and the ways in which this congregation has practiced and nurtured resilience as a community, with the hope that by hearing these stories, we can think about the ways in which our connection to this congregation or to other communities that we've been a part of help shape our own capacity to be resilient, the relationship between ourselves and the communities that we're a part of. So the first story takes place all the way back in the beginning when the church was still new. This church was founded in 1866, and it was founded by a very dynamic community of people who wanted to have a universalist church in Kent. And it was the height of universalism. There was a time when universalism was kind of on the rise in the country, and there were universalist churches opening all over the place, especially in Ohio. Universalism had the most churches in Ohio out of any other place in the country at one point in time. So universalism was on the rise. There was this community of people in Kent who had this strong sense that they wanted a universalist church, and they found a young man who would be the minister of this congregation who was dynamic and committed and joined with this group of people, and his name was Andrew Wilson. So the church started strong, and it grew. It started with 19 charter members who got together and said, we're going to make this church. And then over the next 13 years, it grew and grew and grew and grew. So 13 years into the venture of having this congregation, there were 186 members of the Universalist Church in Kent. And they were a strong group. They were a dynamic group. They were a spiritually grounded group, and it seemed like their future was bright. But then Andrew Wilson, Reverend Andrew Wilson, got the opportunity to go be part of the founding of Buchtel College, which later became the University of Akron. And he felt that he couldn't pass up that opportunity. So he left to go be the financial secretary at Buchtel College. And he was the minister of three churches. There were Universalist churches in Kent, Brimfield, and Ravenna. And he felt that he couldn't continue to serve all three of those congregations and be the financial secretary at Buchtel College. So he had to let at least one go. And he decided that he would leave, he would resign from this church. And he continued to serve the congregations in Brimfield and Ravenna. So it was partly that. It was partly his leaving. The congregation floundered a bit with his leaving. And it was partly the fact that Universalism, they didn't know this then, but we can see this now looking back in history, Universalism had hit its climax in the country and was beginning a long, slow, steady decline as the message, the theological message of Universalism was making an impact on other liberal denominations that were embracing some of that message. So the congregation began to decline, and it declined and declined, so that 10 years later, after Reverend Andrew Wilson left the congregation, the church had shrunk from its high of 186 members down to just over 30. And those 30 members were tired of sustaining a church all by themselves. And they had been in the building for over 20 years, and so the building was showing signs of age, and it needed attention, including some problems that they discovered, perhaps with the original building, faults in the original building that had gotten exacerbated over time. So at this time, it was 1889, foundation in the church was leaking, so the basement was regularly wet, and there was mildew growing on the walls, and there were ventilation problems, and not only that, the rest of the building, the interior of the building, was showing signs of age. And dispirited by these building problems and also by the lack of energy they were feeling to sustain their programming, the church had kind of become a little stagnant. There was a time of rapid change in ministers, and so they had another new minister in this year, and that minister's name was Abby Danforth. She was the first female minister to serve this congregation, and she came in with a kind of can-do spirit, and she said to the folks, well, let's just make a couple small changes. So they re-wallpapered the sanctuary, and that was so cheering that their spirits felt uplifted. And they said, well, let's restart the ladies' sewing circle, which is a group they used to have and loved. So they restarted that, and that was wonderful. And they said, let's restart the Thursday night prayer meeting. So they started those again, and that was wonderful. And then they said, let's raise the money to fix that leaking problem in the basement and take care of that mildew. So they did that too. And within 2 years' time, they had turned around that stagnant energy and were again moving towards growth. Now, the story of this church is one of ups and downs and ups and downs. And sometimes I tell people this church seems to have had 9 lives of, you know, growing and rising and being a thriving congregation and then sort of shrinking and turning in on itself. So there are lots of stories in between that time and the time I want to now tell you about, which was about 100 years after that time. It was in the early 1970s. So some of you were here then. Raise your hand if you were here then in the early 1970s. The Slaters were here then, so they lived through this story. So just a little prelude. The longest-serving minister of this congregation was John Flint. He served for 19 years, from 1943 to 1962, and he was Olive Hobbs' minister for a long time, Olive and Clinton. They remember him fondly, and that was a time of great stability for the congregation. The congregation was stable and thriving and things were going really well here. So he retired in 1962, and the 60s were upon the country, and there was a liberalizing force in what Unitarian Universalism, because the two denominations were joining together. So there was this liberalizing force, and some of the members of this congregation who had been here all that time were not so sure that they really wanted to move in this more liberal direction. So there was some conflict about that in the early 60s. But the more liberal, progressive element in the congregation prevailed, and the congregation decided to host this coffee house. It was called the Yellow Unicorn Coffee House, and it was hosted in the basement. And there was a coffee house and music, and they also provided draft counseling for people who were opposed to the Vietnam War. And this was controversial amongst a few members of the congregation. And then the war continued on. And of course, as we know now from the vantage point of history, there was conflict about the war, and people had different opinions about that. And that conflict came to Kent, it came to this congregation, and as we know, it came tragically to Kent in 1970 with the terrible events at Kent State University. And after that happened, the congregation kind of faced a crisis point, because I don't know who it was, but someone in the congregation at that time, a member, proposed to the congregation that they should vote to refuse to pay the telephone tax, which was a tax at the time that was excised on all the people in the country to help support the war effort. And this was a controversial tax. And some members of the church said, let's vote not to pay that tax. And so there was discussion, and there was a vote, and the church indeed decided, we're not going to pay that tax. And some members of the congregation left in protest over that decision. It was kind of the breaking point, but it was all the things that led up to that. And so the congregation once again shrunk. And there was conflict in the city. Small congregation, just over 30 members, once again facing lack of resources in terms of people resources, but also lack of financial resources to deal with a building that had many, many, many issues of deferred maintenance. And some people thought that the problems were just too great, that they were insurmountable. The problems were interior and exterior. The bricks were crumbling. Many of the problems were being hid by ivy that was growing up the sides of the building. But once again, there was a core group of people here who said, we can do this. And again, this was a time of great flux in ministers. Ministers were here for short periods of time serving this congregation. The minister who had been here during the war crisis years, a couple of years, Bill Schultz, was a student, and he left to go pursue his seminary studies. And so the next minister who came was Vi Kochendorfer. And she came, and she found this small congregation with a little glowing coal of people who said, we're going to find a way to tackle these problems. And so they did. They got a gift of money, because one of the things they did was reach out to people who had been members of the congregation back in the 40s and the 50s when things were stable and growing. And they found a member, her name was Caroline Rowe, who made a gift of a few thousand dollars. And that few thousand dollars was used to, once again, repair the basement, which was a problem. And so they repaired the basement, and Caroline Rowe, the foundation drains were a problem. So they made that repair, and Caroline Rowe was pleased with that fiscally sound decision, and so she made a much larger gift of $18,000, which was a lot of money in 1972, and the congregation said, we're going to be able to use this if we add our own resources to it. We're going to be able to use this to make significant improvements, and so they did. And many people, the Slaters were just, I was talking with them before the service, many people who are still members of the congregation and folks who have died in recent years were a part of that effort. Robert Files, who was a member at that time, estimated that the members of the congregation put in about $60,000 worth of their own sweat equity in addition to the money that had been given by Carolyn Rowe to repair the building. And so they did significant work, repainting, repapering, stenciling, recarpeting, cleaning, and people who were a part of that included the Eldridges. Liz Erickson was a significant leader in that work. Olive Hobbs, Clinton Hobbs, many people who we are indebted to for their work to turn things around at that period in the 70s. We're better off today because of their commitment of time, energy, money, and love. So there are a lot more stories that I could tell you, but I lift up just these two because I think that they exemplify the ways in which this church and its history can teach us something about resilience. L. Gail Irwin wrote an essay on resilience in churches, which inspired our call to worship this morning. And she talked about what we can learn from succulent plants. And she says, resilient churches can learn something from succulent plants. Resilient churches might downsize in the lean years and challenge themselves to grow when material and spiritual gifts abound. They might practice maintaining the spiritual health of their members so they don't dry up by depleting their spiritual gifts. And they might spread their roots wide instead of deep so that they can be affected by and can affect changes in the community. And all of those things are things that this congregation has done repeatedly throughout its history. Resilience comes from flexibility, she says, not from rigidness. And our church has demonstrated that it understands that lesson. By being flexible and adapting to new circumstances, our church has grown and changed and continues to thrive, now almost 150 years after it was founded. So I believe that we all have a need to be part of something that's larger than ourselves, which is another reason that I wanted to sing that hymn. And we find that something larger in many ways. We find it in our families, we find it in communities and groups, we find it in schools and in the hobbies we do, in our jobs, in the service that we perform as volunteers in the community. We find it in congregations and in forests and on seashores and in the stars. We find it in that mystery, which is known to us by so many names. Wherever we find that connection in a group of people, we also find stories. And the stories we tell about facing challenges and growing through them can give us the confidence we need to do the same in our own lives. So whether or not you share the home that you live in with others, you share this home, or you could choose to share this home with the people who call this place home. A spiritual home. Everything has not always gone well for the people who came before us. There were times when life handed them more lemons than roses. But when that happened, they didn't despair. They found a new vision and the courage to grow toward that vision. They remember the importance of celebration and rest along the way. They emphasized gratitude for the gifts that always remained. They said thank you, even in the hard times. And in the good times, they devoted themselves with energy and purpose toward fulfillment of their potential and realization of their dreams. And now it's our turn. And so my question to leave you with today, is whether you feel that you would like to be more resilient in your own life or encourage more resilience in the lives of the people you love. If the answer is yes, I encourage you to look toward our history. It can guide us. Their wisdom is ours to carry forward. Amen, and blessed be. As the ushers come forward, we have a special reflection moment from Jesse and Bobby Beal.
Jesse and I were asked to talk for a moment in service of our campaign, our stewardship campaign, to discuss or to highlight for you some of the RE services in this congregation, and RE stands for Religious Education. You're so tall when I have to stand like this. And when we started this venture together, he was about like this. And we've come a long way together at this church. And RE has meant so many things to us. As a matter of fact, our first venture into this church, originally, we're from Canton, which is about 45 minutes south of here. And we went to the Canton UU church. Jesse really doesn't even remember that. He was 3 and 4 years old. And it was a lovely, small church in borrowed space. And it was one of those moments in a church's life where they had, 30 people. And I felt like to attend there meant that I had to work nonstop. I was just a part of the working of it. And I didn't feel like I could relax and benefit from the spiritual nourishment that I really was looking for. And Jesse was one of only 2 or 3 kids who ever appeared there. And I felt like I wanted him to have a better community or a bigger community of people to hang out with and sort of grow up with. I grew up in a Mennonite church up the road in Aurora and was very active in the youth group, and always there were dozens and dozens of kids of all ages at all times, and I was looking for that for him. And Hogwarts hit our screen somehow. And so in the very earliest days of our Hogwarts program, which is remotely associated with the whole RE thing, we got involved with that first. And so we entered through the School of Wizardry.
Before the School of Wizardry, I honestly, like, I didn't really care much at all about spirituality. It really was not important to me. But then when I went there, they kind of, like, brought it all together by, instead of just teaching us, like, potions and magic, which they did, don't get me wrong, they did teach us a bunch of those things, they taught us how spirituality and magic and love are all kind of the same thing wrapped up together. And it, like, really got me invested in, like, just being a more spiritual person and helping, like, find a faith.
So we came in through Hogwarts and started attending, and by that time, Danny joined our family, and we have been attending ever since, and the RE program is probably so much more complicated and diverse than you can even imagine sitting there, unless you've been here for a long time, and I wanted to give you a couple of statistics that they passed on to us. Jesse, how many adult volunteers do you think participate in all those programs?
20.
Over 40, which is pretty incredible when you think of what percentage that is of the entire church population. Over 40 of us volunteer for all sorts of things, and let me talk about some of those things for just a second. You have all the RE classrooms for all the different age groups, and not only do you have those, they have to service kids in both services. And so we have all sorts of things patched together for them to do. We have different specialty programs, including the multi-generational worship that happens for the kids who don't have a specific RE class at that service. We have the OWL program, which is Our Whole Lives Comprehensive Sexuality Education. And can I just tell you, as a parent, that was the single best thing that was offered for my growing teen.
Well, it was kind of like being on the back of the bus, except you had teachers and people who knew what they were talking about to kind of help you develop who you were as a person in all sorts of different ways and teach you about tons of things.
We won't get into those details here on Sunday morning, but let me tell you, those details came out, and it was important that they came out where it was safe and where it wasn't their parent talking to them and where they had peer support. And I can't tell you, I think Jesse is a healthier, more wholesome guy because of that particular program. But the gems that we have in the RE program are many. They have a coming-of-age program. They have, of course, adult RE programs. And I've participated in them all. I love coming to this church, however, because ultimately it's about the community. It is exactly what Melissa's been talking about this morning, and this is a very resilient and resilient building community, and I'm proud to be a member of it, and I believe that we're going to go on to do even more great things. Thank you.
In times of change, grief, and sadness, how can I breathe, have faith, and let it go? How can I feel a joy with that easy kind of gladness? When life just keeps throwing changes, I never would have chose. Well, I'm traveling life's turns on life's terms, but it's not easy, nobody to show me the road. I'm seeking one love in the rough roads and the rocks ahead of me, singing out a song full of hope. How can I travel a road when the changes are never ending? How can I follow a path when I'm tired and getting old? A winding, turning, broken heart's a busy mending, and the memories on this highway are staring me in the soul. Well, I'm traveling life's turns on life's terms, but it's not easy, nobody to show me the road. I'm seeking one love in the rough roads and rocks ahead of me, singing out a song full of hope. It's not so bad, just a little tired, waiting for the freedom and the beauty. I know that these hard times of change will come and go. I never give up, I never give in, but the load in my heart is heavy. waiting for the sun to shine, and I know I'll be heading home. You know I'm living through these times with gratitude and patience. I'm seeing how the rough roads are bound to make me grow. When something breaks me, let my body feel the changes. Let me be a witness to the wisdom of my soul. Well, I'm traveling life's turns on life's terms, but it's not easy. Nobody to show me the road. I'm seeking one love in the rough roads and rocks ahead of me, singing out a song full of hope. Singing out a song full of hope.
Our worship ends and our service begins, so let us go knowing we have many gifts to share, with worship echoing in our lives. Go in peace.